8. Indian and Torno Atras woman beget Lobo. 9. Lobo and Indian woman beget Zambaigo. 10. Zambaigo and Indian woman beget Cambujo. 11. Cambujo and mulatto woman beget Albarazado. 12. Albarazado and mulatto woman beget Barquino. 13. Barquino and mulatto woman beget Coyote. 14. Coyote woman and Indian beget Chamiso. 15. Chamiso woman and mestizo beget Coyote mestizo. 16. Coyote mestizo and mulatto woman beget Ahi Teyastas. To the north, England brought Africans to their own colonies in the 1600s to work their fields. The Africans worked at first alongside European servants, subject to the same laws, but over the course of decades, the colonial governments gradually singled out the people from Africa for harsh treatment. By the early 1700s, free Negroes had lost the right to vote or bear arms, while those still enslaved were recognized by the law as slaves for life, and their children inherited their bondage. Ham's curse grew wildly popular in the British colonies as a moral justification for these laws. Ministers proclaimed Noah's divine prophecy in sermons, and pamphlets circulated in the American South explaining how God turned the skin of Ham's children dark as a sign of their sin. Africans inherited their enslavement as surely as they inherited their color. Over the course of the 1700s, Ham's curse became downright biological. Slavery's defenders now began drawing up catalogs of essential differences between the white and Negro races. The blacks born here to the third and fourth generation are not at all different in color from those Negroes who are brought directly from Africa, a Jamaican plantation owner named Edward Long observed in 1774. Instead of hair, Long claimed, his slaves had a covering of wool like the bestial fleece. When Long turned to the minds of slaves, the differences from Europeans seemed even more profound. They have no plan or system of morality among them, Long declared. They are represented by all authors as the vilest of the human kind. By the late 1700s, slaveholders could apply a scientific veneer to these beliefs. Naturalists argued that just as animal and plant species could be divided into varieties, so too could Homo sapiens. Carl Linnaeus defined four races. Americanus, reddish, choleric, paints himself with fine red lines, regulated by customs. Asiaticus, sallow, melancholy, haughty, avaricious, ruled by opinions. Africanus, black, women without shame, indolent, governed by caprice. And Europeus, white, inventive, governed by laws. A few decades after Linnaeus, the German anthropologist Johann Friedrich Blumenbach proposed a new system of five races instead of four. His races were Caucasian, Mongolian, Ethiopian, American, and Malay. Blumenbach came up with the label Caucasian after studying a skull in his collection from a woman who lived in the Caucasus Mountains. It was, he later said, the most beautiful skull he ever laid eyes on. She belonged to the same race as people who lived across Europe, Blumenbach believed. He thought the reason that Caucasians had such beautiful skulls was that they were the first people created by God. They retained humanity's original glory, while other people degenerated, producing the other four races. Blumenbach's system became popular over the 19th century, but many of the nuances of his ideas were lost along the way. Blumenbach argued that there was no sharp geographical divide between the races, for example, with each race blending insensibly into neighboring ones. Later, anthropologists tried instead to pinpoint fixed anatomical differences. Some even went so far as to reject the idea that humans had a single origin. They argued that every human race had been separately created and forever locked into its place in the divine hierarchy. There was never any question as to how that order was stacked. At the top, one 1852 American textbook explained, was the white race, who is distinguished above them all, the most perfect type of humanity. This racial hierarchy had to remain intact and legally clear-cut, no matter how confusing reality was. For all the imaginary walls that were erected between the races, sex forever threatened to bring them down. Early on in the American colonies, black and white indentured servants would sometimes marry and have children. By the end of the 17th century, colonial governments had laws in place to stop that practice. The Virginia House of Burgesses labeled the children of black and white parents as an abominable mixture and spurious issue. These interracial children were deemed Negroes as well, and thus slaves. The words that described them had legal weight, even if they were scientifically absurd. Colonial governments were pretending that the flow of heredity from white parent to Negro child could be arbitrarily severed. Despite all the laws, more interracial children were born, not just to Negro slaves, but to free Negroes as well. Some stayed in Negro communities, where their own children ended up inheriting more African ancestry. Others wound up with so much European ancestry that they sometimes chose to pass as white. Like the Spanish governors before them, southern states developed a vocabulary to bring some order to their human property. But if they looked closely at their words, they grew uncertain. Was African blood so potent, so poisonous, lawmakers wondered, that inheriting even a drop would overwhelm a much greater portion of white blood? In 1848, a judge in South Carolina tried to answer the question and failed. When the mulatto ceases, and a party bearing some slight taint of the African blood ranks as white, is a question for the solution of a jury, he concluded. Frederick Douglass took pleasure in forcing his fellow Americans to recognize how badly their racial classifications failed to align with reality. "My father was a white man, or nearly white," he wrote in his autobiography. "It was sometimes whispered that my master was my father." Douglass's mother was a Maryland slave named Harriet Bailey, who worked as a field hand. His biographers consider it likely that her owner, Aaron Anthony, raped her along with a number of his other female slaves, and then used these children of his for slave labor. Although Douglass may have inherited Anthony's DNA, he did not inherit the legal status that came with it. Instead, Douglass grew up as a slave, driving cows to grazing fields and keeping them out of his father's garden. Anthony loaned Douglass out at age 8 to his son-in-law's brother in Baltimore. There, Douglass did an assortment of jobs until 1838, when he used false papers to slip aboard a northbound train. Over the next few years, Douglass started a newspaper and began lecturing across the country in favor of abolition. In 1848, when he traveled aboard a steamboat across Lake Erie to a convention in Buffalo, his fellow passengers recognized him and pleaded for him to give an impromptu speech. Douglass stood up and delivered his case against slavery. "During my remarks, I convicted the slaveholder of theft and robbery," he reported back to his newspaper. An actual slaveholder, it turned out, was aboard the ship that evening. The man stood up, with a most contemptuous sneer on his face, Douglass recalled, declaring, "It was not to be supposed that any white man would condescend to discuss this question with a nigger." Douglass decided to reply with a somewhat facetious account of my genealogy. He told the slaveholder that he was much mistaken in supposing me to be a nigger. Instead, Douglass declared, "I was but a half-negro, that my dear father was as white as himself, and if he could not condescend to reply to negro blood, to reply to the European blood." The slaveholder could not. He stamped away, astonished. Douglass recalled that such sentiments and impudences he had heard from my lips could be tolerated and applauded by white men in any part of this Union. 2 decades later, America's slaves would be emancipated. The former Confederate states kept searching for a way to oppress them, and to do so they needed a reliable way to identify different races. Even a drop of black blood became enough to exclude a person from whiteness. In 1924, the state of Virginia enshrined this practice as law by passing the Racial Integrity Act, which barred interracial marriages. The law defined whites much like the Spanish had 300 years earlier. White people were those whose blood is entirely white, having no known demonstrable or ascertainable admixture of the blood of another race. There was just one problem with this one-drop rule. The Virginia law defined whiteness as the absence not only of black blood, but of Indian blood, too. Ever since the days of John Randolph, many prominent white Virginians had boasted of being direct descendants of Pocahontas. The Racial Integrity Act would have rendered them no longer white. That would simply not do, and so the state legislature tacked on a so-called Pocahontas exception. Even if Virginians were up to 1/16 Native American, the revised law held, they would still be considered white. People who were 1/16 black, on the other hand, were still black. It might be comforting to dismiss the Racial Integrity Act as a monstrosity from a vanished racist past, but when the law was passed in 1924, genetics had already been around for almost a quarter of a century, and some of its most prominent figures gave their support to the law. Many eugenicists not only wanted to stop inferior white people from having children, they also wanted to keep the white race genetically pure. Racism had been a fundamental feature of eugenics ever since Francis Galton coined the word. When Galton studied the heredity of talent, he compared it in different races. Without any reliable way to actually make such a measurement, he simply used his intuitions. Thinking back on his travels through southern Africa, he concluded that he and his fellow white explorers were far more talented than the Africans they encountered. The mistakes the Negroes made in their own matters were so childish, stupid, and simpleton-like as frequently to make me ashamed of my own species, Galton wrote. Africans inherited that childishness, Galton believed, in the same way that they inherited their curly hair or dark skin. The great talents of northern Europeans were just as hereditary, he believed. When Galton promoted eugenics, he promised that careful breeding would make northern Europeans even more talented, and the benefits would redound to all the inferior races, too. Throughout their global empires, Galton believed, northern Europeans ought to use eugenics to improve those lower races as much as their heredity would allow. Galton wrote about race with the cool abstraction of an English gentleman who spent most of his time in London clubs and meetings of scientific societies. For some white American scientists, the question of race was far more urgent and intimate. In the Jim Crow years after the Civil War, millions of blacks boarded trains headed out of the South to cities like New York and Chicago. Those cities were also taking in immigrants from abroad at the same time, no longer just northern Europeans, but huge numbers of Italians, Poles, Russians, and Jews, along with Chinese and Latin Americans. Some white scientists responded to this sudden mixture by trying to put old-fashioned racism on a new scientific footing. A scientist named Harvey Jordan experienced a fairly typical anxiety for his time. Jordan grew up in the late 1800s in rural Pennsylvania, where, he later wrote, he was impressed with the importance of heredity while playing about the barns. Rather than become a farmer, though, Jordan went to college and became an expert on anatomy, studying at Cornell, Columbia, and Princeton. He spent the summer of 1907 in Cold Spring, New York, where he met Charles Davenport. Davenport taught him the new science of genetics, and, from Cold Spring, Jordan headed straight to the University of Virginia to become an anatomy professor and help modernize its medical school. In all that work, heredity was first and foremost on his mind. Jordan was appalled to discover in Virginia the distressing racial conditions in our colored population in the South. But he didn't see these conditions as being caused by social forces. Instead, biology was to blame. Its solution must therefore be eugenics, a state-run program of control over who got to have children. Jordan thought it would be especially useful to encourage mulattoes to have children with full-blooded blacks in order to spread white genes among their children. They would act like yeast in bread dough, he thought, as a leaven in lifting the colored race to a higher level of innate mental and moral capacity. Before such a program could be put in place, Jordan believed it would be necessary to uncover the genetic foundation of the races. He would need the guidance of his eugenic gurus to carry out the task. I have been wondering if I could be of service in this great work, Jordan wrote to Davenport in 1910, perhaps in gathering statistics at close range. Just as Davenport had assigned Henry Goddard to study the heredity of feeble-mindedness, he tutored Jordan on how to investigate the heredity of race. They agreed that Jordan would start by studying the most obvious feature that appeared to set the races apart, skin color. Jordan found four families of mulattoes. To measure their skin color, he brought with him a colored top. The top, a child's toy made by the Milton Bradley Company, had become popular among anthropologists as a way to measure skin color. It had wedges of yellow, black, red, and white. If the top was set spinning fast enough, the colors blurred together into a single hue. By adjusting the size of the wedges, the scientists could change the blurred color. Jordan would have his mulatto subjects hold out their arm and spin his top next to it. He would keep adjusting the colors on the top until he reached a matching shade. Then he would write down the size of the different wedges that produced the match. Jordan sent his color numbers to Davenport, along with pedigrees of his mulatto families. Their data suggested that the color of children was not simply a blend of their parents' skin. In a single mulatto family, the children might range from light to dark. The way in which they inherited their color, Davenport realized, hinted that the trait followed Mendel's law, passed down through the generations by hidden factors. Davenport wanted to publish the data, but he was worried that the results might not hold up. If it turned out that the children were illegitimate, Jordan's pedigrees would be rendered useless. When Davenport told Jordan about his concerns, Jordan assured him he had nothing to worry about. "There isn't the least doubt, I think, about the legitimacy of the children," Jordan wrote. "One man is a minister, one principal of the colored school, one a thriving merchant, and one a barber, and all seem considerably above the grade of morality and intelligence of the ordinary, stupid, and irresponsible Negro." Davenport and his wife, Gertrude, combined Jordan's data with other pedigree studies and published all the results in the American Naturalist. For the most part, they wrote with clinical detachment about skin color. It would be hard to tell whether they were discussing humans or pea plants. Skin color in Negro X white crosses is not a typical blend, as conceived by those who oppose the modern direction of research in heredity, they declared. In their private correspondences, though, Davenport and Jordan were frank about their ambitions for a greater study of racial heredity. Skin color was just the start. Jordan went on to publish a study in which he claimed blacks are more prone to tuberculosis than whites. In 1913, he amassed an entire catalog of unit characters inherited by Negroes, including physical strength, capacity for routine, and melodic endowment. Intelligence was not on the list, for the Negro cannot undergo mental development beyond a certain definite maximum, Jordan said. Davenport shared Jordan's faith in fundamental differences in the mental capacities of blacks and whites. In 1917, Davenport laid out his views in an essay called "The Effects of Race Intermingling." Mixed-race children would suffer because the biology of their parents would be mismatched within them. One often sees in mulattoes an ambition and push combined with intellectual inadequacy, which makes the unhappy hybrid dissatisfied with his lot and a nuisance to others, Davenport wrote. When Virginia lawmakers began to draft the Racial Integrity Act, Davenport and Jordan pitched in to make it law. Davenport sent advice to the bill's architects, while Jordan worked through Virginia's Anglo-Saxon Club, whose name speaks for itself, to lobby for the bill's passage. The law would stand until 1967, when an interracial couple named Mildred and Richard Loving were convicted of breaking it. The Supreme Court ruled in their favor and struck down the law. By the time the Lovings won their case, many scientists had already decided that race, in the sense of the word as it was used by biologists like Jordan in early 20th century America, did not exist. As Davenport and Jordan were spinning their color tops and drawing their racial pedigrees, other researchers were drawing a different image of humanity. They saw the variations in our species as too complex and too interwoven with historical events to reduce to simplistic racial caricatures. Starting in 1897, the sociologist and activist W.E.B. Du Bois led a massive study on the Negro residents of Atlanta. His team measured their weight, height, skull size, infant mortality rates, and a host of other vital signs. Du Bois combined the survey results with a synthesis of worldwide anthropological research in his 1906 book, The Health and Physique of the Negro American. Du Bois did not present the Negro American as a uniform type of human being. Negro Americans were a population within which individuals varied tremendously in every regard. In turn, the Negro population itself was intimately connected to other human populations. "The human species so shade and mingle with each other," Du Bois wrote, "that not only indeed is it impossible to draw a color line between black and other races, but in all physical characteristics, the Negro race cannot be set off by itself as absolutely different." Like anthropologists before him, Du Bois studied the outward features of humans. But in the early 1900s, other scientists began observing our inner variability. The Polish serologist Ludwig Hertzfeld proved that blood types were inherited according to Mendel's law. World War I forced him to put that research on hold, and yet it ultimately provided him with an unprecedented chance to see how blood types varied across human populations. In 1917, Ludwig and his wife, Hanka, traveled to the Macedonian city of Salonika to work as doctors, treating the thousands of Allied soldiers who were finding refuge in the city. Surrounded by a German cordon, Salonika became the most crowded and cosmopolitan spot in the universe, one observer later said. The Hertzfelds saw an opportunity to get a global view of blood types for the first time. Up until then, they had studied the blood types only of Germans, with little idea of how they compared to people from other parts of the world. In Salonika, they were living alongside soldiers from as far away as Senegal, Madagascar, and Russia. The Hertzfelds began asking soldiers and refugees if they'd give some blood. Eventually, the couple ended up with samples from 8,400 people, representing 16 ethnic groups. If the Hertzfelds had tried to gather that much blood in peacetime, their travels might have taken a decade. The patterns they discovered did not fit any simple division between races. The four known blood types, A, B, AB, and O, turned up in every country they surveyed. The only distinguishing feature was the proportion of types. In England, 43.4% had type A, and 7.2% type B. In India, it was type B that was more common, at 41.2%. Only 19% had type A. The Hertzfelds calculated a biochemical race index for each country, dividing the frequency of type A by type B. The index was highest in northwestern Europe and tapered away to the south and east. The Hertzfelds then grouped these national types into three regions, the European type, the intermediate type, and the Asio-African type. The Hertzfelds were well aware that the types they were constructing would confuse traditionally minded scientists. How, for example, could Asians and Africans be put in one group? Our biochemical index in no way corresponds to race in the usual sense of the word, the Hertzfelds warned. The complexity that W.E.B. Du Bois saw in the Negroes of Atlanta, that the Hertzfelds saw in the blood of warring nations, demanded a richer view of heredity, one in which genetic variations were liberally spread across populations and had freedom to flow from one population to another. But in the early 1900s, short of bringing thousands of people together in a besieged city, it was impossible to map the genetic geography of our species. Instead, some of the most important early lessons about race came from other species, such as a little brown fly that lived on the west side of North America. The fly, known as Drosophila pseudo-obscura, was studied by a Soviet émigré named Theodosius Dobzhensky. Dobzhensky spent his childhood catching butterflies and became a published expert on beetles at age 18. His childhood insect hunts gave him a deep appreciation for nature's rich complexity. Looking at the markings and colors of his specimens, he could see the enormous variation that a single species could contain. He could spot differences from one insect to another, and he could also observe differences between populations. Biologists sometimes called these recognizable populations subspecies. Sometimes they called them races. As a young scientist, Dobzhensky learned of Thomas Hunt Morgan's work on flies. It was a revelation for him. Morgan was tying the visible features of insects that Dobzhensky could see, their wings, their halteres, their spots, to the inner workings of their genes. In 1927, Dobzhensky got a fellowship to spend a year with Morgan in New York. The Soviet Union let Dobzhensky go, assuming he would return home when the fellowship ended. But Dobzhensky cherished his escape from Soviet tyranny and embraced the liberal democracy he found in the United States. He would never set foot in the Soviet Union again. In 1928, Morgan headed west to the California Institute of Technology, and Dobzhensky went with him to the orange-scented hills of Pasadena. Once Dobzhensky had settled into his new western home, he drew up a plan to study how genetic variations were spread out over the range of a wild species. He knew he couldn't study Morgan's favorite, Drosophila melanogaster. It was a garbage-feeding camp follower. Instead, Dobzhensky picked Drosophila pseudo-obscura, a truly wild animal that lived across a range stretching from Guatemala to British Columbia. Dobzhansky bought a Model A Ford and started driving into remote mountain ranges to catch flies from isolated populations. Back in Pasadena, he bred the flies and inspected their chromosomes under a microscope. Comparing one fly to another, Dobzhansky sometimes spotted a section of a chromosome that was flipped. These so-called inversions acted like a crude genetic marker. Dobzhansky would find many of the same inversions in different parts of North America. Just as with blood types, the inversions marked no sharp geographical divisions between populations of flies. At best, they were more common or less so from place to place. As Dobzhansky surveyed his flies, his thoughts turned to his fellow humans. The rise of the Nazis in the 1930s disgusted him intensely. He found the way they used a biological definition of race to persecute Jews both vicious and anti-scientific. While Dobzhansky dearly loved his adopted country, he also recognized the racism that still infested it, including among many of the older American geneticists he met. Dobzhansky confronted America's race obsession for himself on a visit to Cold Spring in 1936. He met Edward East, a geneticist who had declared a few years earlier that the Negro race possessed undesirable traits that justified not only a line, but a wide gulf to be fixed permanently between it and the white race. On meeting Dobzhansky, East assured him that, as a brilliant scientist, he could not possibly be a genetically inferior Russian. East was confident Dobzhansky must belong to the small population of Nordics who lived in Russia. Starting in the late 1930s, Dobzhansky began declaring publicly that popular notions of human races and white superiority had no basis in biology. In best-selling books, he explained how populations of any animal were a mix of genetic variants. It might be possible to tell one population from another with statistics, but that was a far cry from claiming that all the animals in one population were alike. In fact, the animals with a single population could be tremendously different, genetically speaking. The idea of a pure race is not even a legitimate abstraction, Dobzhansky wrote. It is a subterfuge to cloak one's ignorance. What was true for flies must be true for humans, Dobzhansky asserted. The laws of heredity are the most universally valid ones among biological regularities yet discovered, he declared. Dobzhansky granted that humans certainly varied, and that some of that variation was spread out geographically. But if human races were sharply defined, then you'd expect to find sharp boundaries between them. And that was almost never possible. While it might be possible to tell an Australian Aborigine from a Belgian by a trait like skin color, another trait, like the prevalence of type B blood, might unite them. Dobzhansky didn't want to do away with the concept of races completely. He wanted people to see them for just how modest and blurry they really were. Dobzhansky defined races as nothing more than populations which differ in the frequencies of some gene or genes. After World War II, a number of other geneticists and anthropologists joined Dobzhansky's campaign. Their efforts culminated in an official statement from the United Nations condemning scientific racism as baseless. But Dobzhansky's new allies pushed the attack further than he had. They demanded scientists give up the term race altogether. It was so fraught with dangerous assumptions that it had to be discarded. The anthropologist Ashley Montague, for example, switched to using the term ethnic groups. But one of Dobzhansky's strongest challenges came from one of his own protégés. In 1951, a young New Yorker named Richard Lewontin came to Dobzhansky's lab at Columbia to study flies. Dobzhansky was the sort of strong-willed professor who steamrolled his graduate students, pushing them to do the experiments he wanted done and to draw the conclusions he had already reached. But Lewontin pushed right back. He was committed to investigating his own scientific questions. What was most important to Lewontin was finding a new way to measure the genetic diversity in Drosophila pseudo-obscura, Dobzhansky's favorite fly. In his own work, Dobzhansky had only managed to get a crude measure of the fly's genetic diversity. He inspected the cells of insects for any that had major changes to their chromosomes. Some flies, for example, had long stretches of DNA that were flipped into reverse order. Lewontin, working with John Lee Hubby at the University of Chicago, developed a new way to look for genetic diversity, one that could detect differences that were invisible under Dobzhansky's microscope. Lewontin and Hubby would grind up fly larvae and extract proteins from them. They would then put the proteins in a slab of electrified gelatin. The electric field dragged the proteins across the slab, pulling lighter proteins farther than heavier ones. In some cases, the scientists found that all the flies made proteins of the same weight. In other cases, however, some flies had lighter versions and others had heavier ones. And in still other cases, a single fly made both heavy and light versions of a protein. The different weights of the proteins were the result of variations in the genes that encoded them. Lewontin and Hubby compared the weight of proteins in six populations of Drosophila pseudoobscura from Arizona, California, and Colombia. Looking at 18 kinds of proteins, they found that 30% existed in different forms within a single population. In other words, these populations were far from genetically uniform. Even individual flies were surprisingly rich in variations. On average, 12% of the proteins in a single fly existed in two forms. Lewontin then applied this same approach to humans. In the early 1900s, scientists knew of only a single protein that varied from person to person, the blood type protein that determines people's ABO blood type. By the 1960s, however, scientists had found a number of other kinds of proteins on the surface of blood cells. And these proteins also varied from person to person. A protein called Rh, for example, is present on some people's cells and missing from others. Doctors have to make sure the Rh factor is the same in a donor and a patient before transfusing blood. Lewontin reviewed studies on these proteins carried out in England. People there had a surprisingly high level of genetic diversity. A third of the proteins varied from person to person. These results gave Lewontin the confidence to broaden his research and take on the great question of race. He embarked on a new study to see how well racial groups aligned with the actual genetic diversity of humans. If races were indeed biologically significant, Lewontin argued, each race should have a starkly distinctive combination of genetic variants. Most of the genetic diversity should exist between the races rather than between individuals of the same race. Lewontin gathered measurements of 17 different proteins in a wide range of human populations, from the Chippewa to the Zulu, from the Dutch to the people of Easter Island. When he sorted people according to their race, he found that the genetic differences between races accounted for only 6.3% of the total genetic diversity in humans. The genetic diversity within populations, such as the Zulu or the Dutch, contained a staggering 85.4%. In 1972, Lewontin published these results in a profoundly influential paper entitled The Apportionment of Human Diversity. He concluded that racial classifications had become entrenched in Western society thanks to optical illusions. People defined races based on features to which human perceptions are most finely tuned: nose, lip, and eye shapes, skin color, hair form, and quantity. But these features were influenced by only a small number of genes. It was wrong to assume that all the other genes people carried followed the same patterns. Given his findings, and given all the suffering that had been justified by racial classifications, Lewontin urged that society set them aside. Human racial classification is of no social value and is positively destructive of social and human relations, he declared. Since such racial classification is now seen to be of virtually no genetic or taxonomic significance either, no justification can be offered for its continuance. It was a sweeping statement to make based on fairly little data. But in the years since, younger generations of scientists have revisited Lewontin's question with better tools. Instead of proteins, they've examined DNA. They've surveyed more people from more populations. In 2015, for example, three scientists, Keith Hunley and Jeffrey Long of the University of New Mexico and Graziella Cabana of the University of Tennessee, studied DNA from 1,037 people belonging to 52 different populations around the world. In each person, they sequenced the same 645 segments of DNA. They looked for the differences in these segments from person to person, calculating their genetic diversity. Hunley and his colleagues confirmed, like others had before them, that most human genetic diversity can be found within populations rather than between the so-called races. And thanks to the huge scale of their study, they could measure human diversity with far greater precision. The people who live in African populations tend to be more genetically diverse from one another than people who live on other continents, for example. The population with the lowest genetic diversity was a small Amazon tribe called the Surui. Yet even the Surui, who number only about 1,120 people, possess about 59% of all the genetic diversity in our entire species. If you wiped out everyone on Earth except the Surui, in other words, nearly two-thirds of humanity's genetic variation would survive. In sum, Hunley and his colleagues said, we concur with Lewontin's conclusion that Western-based racial classifications have no taxonomic significance. The Venn diagram that Sushant Kumar made for me, showing me all the SNPs that are sprinkled over me, a Nigerian, and a Chinese person, felt like a personal emblem of how badly the concept of race explains human genetic diversity. I'd call myself white, and yet 83% of my 3.5 million single nucleotide polymorphisms are shared by either an African or an East Asian. We may inherit some of those shared variants from common ancestors who lived hundreds of thousands of years ago. Some variants may have arisen later thanks to a new mutation. They then spread from population to population as people mix their genes the way people always do. All three of us, me and my pair of anonymous far-flung cousins, got showered in the same genealogical glitter. Race may not be a meaningful biological concept, but it does exist. It has a powerful existence as a tradition of putting people in social categories. Those categories, then, had profound influences on people's lives. Racial categories served as a legal justification to enslave groups of people and declare their children slaves from birth. Race helped turn other people into scapegoats for economic disasters, justifying their slaughter by the millions. Other people were classified into races judged incompetent to make use of their own land, justifying pushing them off it. And racial categories also gave some people the luxury of enjoying those lands and the profits of slave-based economies without having to learn much about their history. Even after racist institutions and laws were abandoned, their effects have endured for generations, extending race's power. Because race is a shared experience, it can join people together who aren't closely related. American blacks gained their collective identity only when they came together as cargo on slave ships bound for the colonies. Slave traders roamed up and down the coasts of Africa to capture people separated by thousands of years of history in Senegal, Nigeria, Angola, even Madagascar. Richard Simpson, a surgeon who traveled to South America in 1689 on an English privateer, observed that throwing strangers together was a crucial step in making slavery a profitable business. The way to keep Negroes quiet, Simpson wrote, is to choose them from several parts of the country, of different languages, so that they find they cannot act jointly. Leaning on the biological concept of race like a crutch has led doctors into some embarrassing blunders in their studies of diseases. There is no race which is so subject to diabetes as the Jews, declared W.H. Thomas, a New York doctor, in 1904. As late as the early 1900s, Jews were considered a distinct race, with its own diseases. To guide their immigration policies, the United States Congress compiled a book called Dictionary of Races or Peoples. The book treated the evidence of the Jewish race as plain to see. The Jewish nose, and to a lesser degree other facial characteristics, are found well nigh everywhere throughout the race, the report declared. Such racial classifications led doctors to look for diseases that were characteristic of each race. Jews, doctors came to agree, had diabetes. The seed of this notion sprouted in 1870 when a doctor in Vienna named Josef Sagan observed that a quarter of his patients were diabetic. Other physicians later concluded that Jews died from diabetes at a far higher rate than other groups. German doctors started referring to diabetes as the Judenkrankheit, the Jewish disease. Between 1889 and 1910, New York saw its rate of diabetes triple. To J.G. Wilson, a physician with the U.S. Public Health Service, the cause was clear: the influx of Jewish immigrants. Jews had some hereditary defect, Wilson said, that made them vulnerable. William Osler, the most important clinical doctor of the early 1900s, blamed the vulnerability of Jews to diabetes on their neurotic temperament, along with their racial tendency to corpulence. And then, in the middle of the 20th century, the universally recognized fact that diabetes was a disease of the Jewish race simply disappeared. Historians can't definitively say why. It's true that a few scientists questioned the statistical evidence behind the Jewish disease, but no one ever published a definitive takedown. Maybe after Nazis peddled myths that Jews were a naturally disease-ridden race, American doctors quietly decided to retire their own misconceptions. Myths like Jewish diabetes do not detract from the fact that some people who identify themselves with certain labels, black, Hispanic, Irish, Jewish, have relatively high rates of certain diseases. Ashkenazi Jews have a higher rate of Tay-Sachs disease than other groups, for example. African Americans have a higher rate of sickle cell anemia than European Americans. Hispanics are 60% more likely to visit the hospital for asthma than non-Hispanic whites. Researchers have also found significant associations between the race of patients and how their bodies respond to drugs. Chinese people tend to be more sensitive to the blood-thinning drug warfarin than whites, indicating they should get a lower dose. In some cases, these patterns are the result of the genes people inherited from their ancestors. But sometimes they aren't. When Richard Cooper went to medical school at the University of Arkansas in the late 1960s, he was stunned at how many of his black patients were suffering from high blood pressure. He would encounter people in their 40s and 50s felled by strokes that left them institutionalized. When Cooper did some research on the problem, he learned that American doctors had first noted the high rate of hypertension in American blacks decades earlier. Cardiologists concluded it must be the result of genetic differences between blacks and whites. Paul Dudley White, the preeminent American cardiologist of the early 1900s, called it a racial predisposition, speculating that the relatives of American blacks in West Africa must suffer from high blood pressure as well. Cooper went on to become a cardiologist himself, conducting a series of epidemiological studies on heart disease. In the 1990s, he finally got the opportunity to put the racial predisposition hypothesis to the test. Collaborating with an international network of doctors, Cooper measured the blood pressure of 11,000 people. Paul Dudley White, it turned out, was wrong. Farmers in rural Nigeria and Cameroon actually had substantially lower blood pressure than American blacks, Cooper found. In fact, they had lower blood pressure than white Americans, too. Most surprisingly of all, Cooper found that people in Finland, Germany, and Spain had higher blood pressure than American blacks. Cooper's findings don't challenge the fact that genetic variants can increase people's risk of developing high blood pressure. In fact, Cooper himself has helped run studies that have revealed some variants in African Americans and Nigerians that can raise that risk. But this genetic inheritance does not, on its own, explain the experiences of African and European Americans. To understand their differences, doctors need to examine the experiences of blacks and whites in the United States, the stress of life in high-crime neighborhoods, and the difficulty of getting good health care, for example. These are powerful inheritances, too, but they're not inscribed in DNA. For scientists carrying out the hard work of disentangling these influences, an outmoded biological concept of race offers no help. In the words of the geneticists Noah Rosenberg and Michael Edge, it has become a sideshow and a distraction. To many people, Rosenberg and Edge may sound as if they're ignoring the evidence staring them in the face. While I may share millions of single nucleotide polymorphisms with a Nigerian, no one would mistake me for someone whose family goes back centuries in Lagos. I once went to Beijing, and never on my trip did someone walk up to me and ask for directions in Mandarin. It is true that humans have physical differences, and some of those differences are spread geographically across the planet. But clinging to old notions about race won't help us understand the nature of those differences, both the ones we can see and the ones we can't. What matters is ancestry. A small band of hominins in Africa evolved into Homo sapiens around 300,000 years ago, after which they expanded across that continent and then across the world. Those journeys shaped the genomes that people inherited from their ancestors. And today, if we look at our own genomes, we can reconstruct some of that history, even back to ancestors who weren't exactly human. Chapter 8, Mongrels. The Teta thrush is cloaked in black feathers and tipped by a vermilion beak. It can be found only in the cloud forests of the Taita Hills of southern Kenya. Some species of birds fly far across wide ranges, but the Taita thrush is a homebody. It limits its movements to a small territory of the forest floor, where it hops about in search of fruit and insects. This way of life left the bird exquisitely vulnerable to modern change. Most of the Taita forests were cleared from the hills for farming and pine tree plantations, leaving behind just a few islands of trees at the summits. By the end of the 20th century, only three populations of Taita thrushes survived. Each numbered just a few hundred. The isolation of the birds left them especially threatened by extinction. Before the deforestation, their genes flowed across the landscape as the birds mated with their neighbors. Now the genes of the Taita thrush were trapped on hilltop islands. As the years passed, each new generation ran a greater risk of inheriting two recessive alleles and developing a genetic disorder, one that might cut a bird's life short or make it infertile. Hoping to save the species, conservation biologists climbed the hills and captured 155 thrushes from all three forests. They drew blood from the birds and later isolated short segments of DNA from them. They studied this genetic material to gauge how much diversity was left. In 1998, a geneticist at the University of Oxford named Jonathan Pritchard asked the scientists if he could look at the sequences. Pritchard sorted them into three groups based on their genetic similarities alone. He then asked the conservation biologists where each bird lived. Each of the groups he created perfectly matched each forest. To sort the Taita thrushes, Pritchard had used a computer program he had recently written with his advisor, Peter Donnelly, and a fellow postdoctoral researcher, Matthew Stevens. They had named the program Structure. Sorting 155 birds by DNA alone was a daunting task. At many positions, their genes were identical. Many of the variants shared by only some birds could be found in more than one forest. But Pritchard and his colleagues recognized that certain combinations were more common in each group than others, a signature of their origins. There was a signal buried in all the genetic noise. When the three forests became isolated, their gene pools got cut off from each other too. In each pool, some variants were common and some were rare. Without birds traveling between the forests, each generation passed down those variants to their descendants. After many generations of isolation, this pattern still held true. The birds in each forest tended to have some common variants, and it was unusual for them to have rare variants. Pritchard used Structure to take advantage of these patterns to sort the birds into groups. He found that three groups worked best. The birds in each of the three groups had a clearer genetic connection to each other than if he had tried sorting them into two groups, or four, or five. Structure was so good at this sorting that Pritchard could pick out a single thrush, look at its DNA, guess which forest it came from, and almost always get the right answer. What made this success even more impressive was the similarity of the Taita thrushes. The birds had become isolated from one another only a century beforehand. These were not distinctive subspecies, in other words. From forest to forest, the birds look pretty much identical. They eat the same food. In every forest, males and females form monogamous bonds. The subtle genetic differences that Pritchard used to trace the birds to their homes meant little to the birds themselves. Pritchard did not invent Structure only to identify the homes of Taita thrushes. He wanted to build a program that could automatically sort individuals from any species into meaningful groups. He especially wanted to apply it to Homo sapiens. In the 1990s, it had become clear that mapping the genetic structure of humanity would be crucial to finding genes associated with diseases. Scientists had begun searching for these genes by looking for variants that were unusually common in people with a particular disease. But they could end up with misleading results if they didn't take into account people's ancestry. This danger came to be known as the chopstick effect, after a fable spun in 1994 by the geneticists Eric Lander and Nicholas Shork. Imagine, Lander and Shork said, that a team of researchers in San Francisco decided they would find the genetic cause for why some people in the city ate with chopsticks and others did not. They took blood samples from a random selection of people and scanned their DNA. Lo and behold, the scientists discovered an allele for an immune system gene that was far more common among chopstick users than among people who did not use them. Therefore, the geneticists concluded, inheriting that allele caused people to be more likely to use chopsticks. They were wrong. The allele was more common in chopstick users for an entirely different reason, because it was more common in Asian Americans than people of European descent. Asian Americans were also more likely to use chopsticks than European Americans. The immune system, in other words, has nothing to do with chopsticks. A real example of the chopstick effect came to light in the 1980s among the Pima Indians of the southwestern United States. They suffer from type 2 diabetes at a catastrophic rate. About half of all adults in the community develop the disease. Diabetes began to wreak havoc on the Pima only in the 1900s, after they lost their land and their sophisticated farming system. Suddenly, they had to survive on carbohydrate-rich government-supplied food. That diet could put anyone at greater risk of diabetes, but the Pima proved to be especially vulnerable. Geneticists suspected that their higher risk was due to genetic variants they shared. William Noller, a researcher with the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, led one of the first studies on Pima DNA. He studied 4,920 subjects on the Pima Reservation in Arizona. He discovered that about 6 out of every 100 Pima carried a variant in a gene called GM, which encodes a type of antibody. The GM variant seemed to protect the Pima against diabetes. Among those who carried it, only 8% developed the disease. Among the Pima who lacked the GM variant, 29% developed diabetes. Noller might have stopped there and declared victory, but he was well aware that the Pima he studied did not have a simple history. Native Americans arrived in the Western Hemisphere some 15,000 years ago. The Pima probably settled in the Southwest by 2,000 years ago, and 5 centuries ago they came into contact with people of European ancestry, first Spanish explorers and then Mexican farmers. By the mid-1900s, Pima Indians and Mexican migrant laborers were working together on Arizona cotton farms. Some Pima started families with people outside the tribe. As a result, some of the Pima whom Noller studied had a fair bit of European ancestry. To take ancestry into account, Noller split his subjects into 2 groups, those with some European background and those with none. When he looked at the GM variant within each group, the evidence for its defense against diabetes disappeared. Among people with 100% Pima ancestry, having the GM variant didn't lower the risk of diabetes. It also didn't make a difference when Noller compared the Pimas with some European ancestry to each other. Noller had been initially fooled by the GM variant, he realized, because it was much more common among Pima with some European ancestry. It served as a genetic marker, in other words, rather than as a direct defense against diabetes. Noller concluded that European versions of certain genes might lower the odds of developing diabetes on a diet high in simple carbohydrates, but he couldn't say from his data which genes those might be. What he did know was that the GM variant merely came along for the ride. Noller managed to overcome the chopstick effect by asking the Pima about their ancestors. Their European forebears had lived recently enough that the Pima could give Noller a reliable genealogy. He was also fortunate to be studying a small, relatively isolated community. Other scientists who study broader populations of people with mixtures of ancestries and fuzzy family memories do not enjoy Noller's advantages. Pritchard and his colleagues, collaborating with Noah Rosenberg at Stanford University, found that they could use structure to overcome the chopstick effect, even when they didn't have any information about people's family trees. The geneticists could identify clusters of people based on their DNA alone. To adapt structure to the task, the scientists had to reckon with the fact that people are not Teta thrushes. They do not live in a few forests in a small patch of Africa. They span the globe. And rather than living in isolation, humans have migrated over thousands of years, mixing their DNA in their living descendants. The scientists created a version of structure that let them scan the genetic variation in people and assign each individual's DNA to one or more groups of ancestors. Pritchard and his colleagues could then look at how well they could account for the genetic variation in people with different numbers of groups. In 2002, Pritchard and his colleagues tried structure out on people. They looked at genetic variations in 1,056 people from around the planet. Just as in other studies of human diversity, they found that the overwhelming amount of genetic diversity was between individuals. The genetic differences between major groups accounted for only 3 to 5%. And yet, With the help of structure, the researchers used some of those variants to sort people into genetic clusters. When the scientists allowed people to descend from 5 different groups, for example, they clustered mostly according to the continents they lived on. People in Africa could trace much of their ancestry to one group, while people in Eurasia were linked to a second one. East Asians traced much of their ancestry to a third, Pacific Islanders to a fourth, and people in the Americas to a fifth. Much to the chagrin of Pritchard and his colleagues, some people mistakenly took these results as evidence for a biological concept of race. But any resemblance between genetic clusters of people and racial categories concocted before genetics existed can have no deep meaning. It would make just as little sense to say that Aristotle's classifications of animals have been vindicated by comparing the DNA of different species. Aristotle put species into categories based on whether they had blood, whether they had hair, and so on. The genes of animals with hair, mammals, show that they do indeed belong to a group. But Aristotle also threw together species into other categories that have no close evolutionary link. It would be a disaster for biology if scientists cast off 2,000 years of progress and followed Aristotle's example. The same is true for race. Those who claim that structure proves the existence of human races also have to ignore how Pritchard and his colleagues actually used it to study human variation. The clusters that the 5 ancestral groups produced didn't have sharp boundaries. Where 2 clusters met on a map of the world, the researchers found people who had some DNA that linked them to one group and some that linked them to the other. What's more, structure allows scientists to try out different numbers of ancestral groups to see what sort of clusters emerge. After trying out 5 ancestral groups, Pritchard and his colleagues decided to see what would happen if they ran their program with 6. The results were pretty much the same, with one telling exception. A single population broke off from the Eurasian cluster and formed a cluster of its own. That population is known as the Kalash, a few thousand people who live in the Hindu Kush Mountains of Pakistan. Their separation in Pritchard's study may tell us something important about the history of the Kalash, perhaps a long isolation from other tribes in Pakistan, allowing them to accumulate a small number of genetic variations that set them off from much larger clusters of people. But it doesn't mean that the Kalash are biologically a race of their own. Pritchard and his colleagues were also able to use structure to search for clusters within clusters. For their study, the researchers had picked out 5 populations of people in the Americas, including the Pima in Arizona and the Surui of Brazil. When they created a model of those people based on 5 ancestral groups, they were able to identify people's tribes based on their DNA alone. In the years since the 2002 paper came out, scientists have been improving on structure, developing more powerful statistical tools for tracing people's ancestry. They've also been accumulating more DNA from more parts of the world to get a more accurate map of the human genetic landscape. Before long, it became possible for genealogy companies to analyze customers' DNA and produce a rough breakdown of their ancestry. It was this approach that allowed LeVar Burton to learn that 3/4 of his ancestry came from sub-Saharan Africa, for example. One of Pritchard's students, Joe Pickrell, ended up at the New York Genome Center. He and his colleagues there used his own update on structure to compare people's DNA and estimate their ancestry. When Pickrell ran my DNA through his computational pipeline, he quickly discovered, not surprisingly, that my ancestry is entirely European. He and his colleagues then examined stretches of my DNA to see if they could trace them to smaller populations within Europe. To find variants that pointed to my northwestern European ancestors, for example, Pickrell and his colleagues looked at the DNA of people from Iceland, Scotland, England, the Orkney Islands, and Norway. The one group they looked at that didn't have a clear geographical location was the Ashkenazi Jews. While Ashkenazi Jews lived for generations across much of Eastern Europe, they remained a culturally closed group, mainly sharing their variants among themselves. They thus became recognizably distinct from neighboring Christians. After a few weeks, Pickrell and his colleagues sent me a pie chart of my ancestry. 43% Ashkenazi Jewish, 25% Northwestern Europe, 23% South Central Europe, Italy in other words, 6% Southwestern Europe, Spain, Portugal, and Southwestern France, 2.2% Northern Slavic, which means the region running from the Ukraine to Estonia, and 1.3% that remained too ambiguous to put on the map. As I pored over the numbers, I grew unsettled. Thinking about all the stories I had told myself about my ancestry since I was young, I realized how often they had let me down. Names have let me down particularly hard. If your name was Carl Zimmer, you might assume you were German. I certainly did. In school, friends would sometimes greet me.